AJ Products, we're dedicated to delivering intelligent solutions tailored for your business needs. Specializing in warehouse and project planning, we bring efficiency and sustainability to the forefront. To elevate your business, visit ajproducts.ie.
It's Friday, February the 23rd, and you're very welcome to the Inside Politics Wrap of the Week from the Irish Times. I'm Hugh Linehan. Pat Leahy and Harry McGee are in studio to discuss the week in politics. Hi, guys.
Hi, Hugh.
Hello, Hugh.
Later on the show, we're going to be remembering our colleague, a former valued contributor to this podcast, Michael O'Regan, who died last week. But first, this is one of those occasions that we need to say as podcasters that events may have moved on from the time you listen to this podcast, from the time when we recorded it, which is about lunchtime on Friday. We are recording now and the board of RTE, Pat, is due to hold an emergency meeting following the shock resignation of its chair, Shuni Rahilig. She resigned following an interview with Media Minister Catherine Martin on primetime last night, in which Martin told the interviewer she had been misinformed about the board's knowledge of the departure of its former chief financial officer. And she also declined at the time to express confidence in O'Rahilig, who resigned a couple of hours later. Did she effectively dismiss the chair on live television?
I mean, it's hard to come to any other conclusion, really. I mean, if a minister goes on primetime in an interview that had been well flagged and everybody in government was watching because they knew she was going on to talk about this. And if she goes on and repeatedly fails to express confidence in the chair of a state board and criticises that state, the chair of that state board, and says that she has been misled by them, it's difficult to understand how she wouldn't regard that as an effective ultimatum. I mean, if Catherine Martin thinks she can do that and nobody resigns, then she doesn't understand part of what being a minister is about.
Okay, so we take that on board then, Harry. Then I suppose the next question that follows is that given the horrible mess which RTE, which is a very large part of the minister's brief, has been in for many months now, was this the best way to sort things out, by sacking the most prominent person connected with the organisation on live television? And really, as I think Director General Kevin Backhurst said today, kind of throwing it into further chaos.
You have essentially answered your own question.
It's a little bit rhetorical.
Yes.
But I suppose I just want to get to why would she want to do that?
That is a question that Catherine Martin will have to ask. But it reminded me a little bit while following it last night of the famous Vladimir Nabokov novel, Invitation to a Beheading. Unfortunately, Shuni Rahilig was the person invited to a beheading, and she realised very quickly the beheading was going to be her own. And as you said, things moved so quickly because the newspapers, the old-fashioned print newspapers that came out this morning, were all saying Shuni Rahilig is in a bit of bother here, you know.
Yeah.
But by which time she'd already gone. She released a statement at 1 a.m.
Went up on IrishTimes.com at 1 a.m. as well, I gather.
It did indeed. And I read it last night because I happened to be working late on a feature. And it...
We're a 24/7 operation.
Yeah, course we are. She was effectively gone. The minister did get clearance from the three leaders, which will give her some degree of cover. But I wonder, did she know the consequences of what she was saying? First of all, in saying that she had been misled, and secondly, refusing to express confidence in the chair on three occasions. And to me, the consequences of that were quite obvious. Shuni Rahilig had nowhere else to go except to resign. And
So you mean there is a possibility then that she fired Shuni Rahilig effectively by accident?
Well, I'm not saying it's by accident, but did she know that the consequences of her interview last night would result in what happened this morning? Because the government did seem to be put slightly on the back foot this morning. But the sum effect of it is that this crisis, which was already serious, has become a maelstrom now. And any further revelations will put the careers of several other very senior people in jeopardy. We see Kevin Backhurst, who might be in a bit of difficulty in relation to this when the details come out. And also Catherine Martin might find herself under pressure. There are some details that need to be teased out. And once those details are known, they might have implications for several people. For example, in a resignation statement, Shuni Rahilig did say that she neglected to mention that the board did sign off on it. But she also said that she told the then Secretary General of the Department in October of the process surrounding the exit
package. In a telephone call.
For Richard Collins. Yeah, in a telephone call. So if she told the details of that to a senior official in the department, the question is, the department were aware of it. And what was the department aware of? What are the details of that? And if it had the requisite level of awareness, why did it not tell the minister? Why did the minister only find out about it, yesterday when Shuni Rally rang
her? This is the question now, because Shuni Rally is saying, I'm sorry, I should have mentioned this to the board. I forgot about it, but I told you in October. So this is the question now. Did she tell them in October? If she did tell them, we presume she's telling the truth, then why did the Secretary General not tell Catherine Martin about that? Or did she tell her and Catherine Martin forgot about it? So what Catherine Martin has done by forcing the resignation of Shuni Rally, I think, has refocused this entire crisis, which up until now has had its glare squarely on RTE. That has now been refocused on the government, on Catherine Martin. So for months, and we've all been talking to ministers about this, and, they all have a view on it, but they all say, it's a big crisis. It's not the government's fault, so we're not that worried about it. But now the government is at the centre of it. I mean, clearly the government is involved before, but now the government is right, and Catherine Martin specifically is right in the spotlight. And that makes it a political problem for the government in a way that it wasn't before. And there's another point as well, which I think is worth making, and that is that there's rumours all around RTE at the moment that the rest of the board is going to resign. Now, I take what you said at the top of the podcast, that events may have moved on by the time people get to listen to this. But if the board walks, or a chunk of the board walks, then Catherine Martin will come under the most intense political pressure, I think.
This is some of the hallmarks of what our colleague Fintan O'Toole once coined the phrase "cockspiracy" to describe a certain kind of Irish political scandal, that always seems to end up with a phone call made at some point in the past to some civil servant who may well have departed the scene at that point, and did they talk to the minister, and there's no paper trail. Now, I don't think myself personally that there's any malintentions underlying all of this. So I think there's more cock than spiracy, if you know what I mean. But I do wonder about, you look at the line of events here. So much of this RTE scandal, Harry, has been about the failure of the executive to inform the RTE board about significant facts which it should have known. And that was a failure of corporate governance. And now here we are, and we have the failure of a government department and a minister to make themselves available on exactly, to make themselves knowledgeable on exactly the same subject, whether or not the RTE board knew about something. So it's, in a way, it's a kind of, the RTE disease has infected the government department.
It has, but you have to make a distinction, Hugh, I think, between the crisis that erupted last year was kind of historical. It was looking back at past practices within RTE. So we had a new brush that came in to sweep everything clean last July when Kevin Backhurst came in. There was a new chair in situ. There was a promise that things would be done properly. The events that we're talking about today are events which have happened since that time. And I think there were a couple of ill-advised decisions by RTE management that probably didn't have... They didn't have the political antennae up to kind of sense.
What do you think they were?
Well, essentially, the confidentiality clauses that associated the exit packages. Number one, very large exit packages for people that they needed to be gone. And it's difficult. I mean, Kevin Backhurst said last week, this isn't America. You can't fire people willy-nilly. So when senior management, especially, and he tried to say all employees, but really, when senior management are going, you have to negotiate deals with them. But the confidentiality clauses, or the NDAs that were built into them, were problematic, especially in the context of what happened before. And there should have been some degree of foreseeability in relation to that they should have seen that this might come back and bite them. And it hasn't been a good week for Kevin Backhurst. Pat wrote a good analysis piece earlier on, kind of setting out all of these things and all of these issues. And the problem, you said, the cockspiracy, which is a very good way that Fintan has described it, because it's the crisis has happened, and then it keeps on kind of, it's like a feeding, the feeding frenzy continues. And it's, as Albert Reynolds said many years ago, it's the little things that, that trip you up. But those little things are really the straw that broke the camel's back. And somebody likened those crises to me one time as somebody getting up in the morning. When you're in the middle of a crisis, you get up in the morning with a skipping rope and you have to skip all day, 24 hours. And if you make one misstep with the skip, you're gone. So things are on the edge, and people are wavering on the edge. And when you look at what's happened over the last 24 hours, in its own light, it's relatively minor. But it's not minor when you look at it in the context of everything else that has happened before. And there is an onus and a responsibility on RTE, given all that has happened, you know, that it has to do everything right. And I know it's an onerous responsibility, but it has to do, because that's the only thing it can do in order to restore public confidence in the broadcaster.
I should note as well, Shunley Rathleague is it's a part-time position, being chair of the RTE board. I think the salary is something around €30,000 a year. She's a kind of a solid, respected professional in the audiovisual industry. I would have thought she performed pretty well in difficult circumstances over the last few months. Now they have to go out and find a replacement.
Yeah.
Who'd want that job?
Well, there's always, it's the first rule of life, there's always some idiot to do it.
What qualified person would want that job?
I think this is why the events of this week have been so damaging for RTE, is that it's the people who came in subsequent to the crisis. Okay, Shun Nirali took up the position before the crisis broke, but any of the events that caused it took place before she arrived. So she was essentially trying to clean up the mess created by other people. My sense is that she was pretty highly regarded across government. And now she's gone. The same thing with Kevin Backhurst, to an extent, who came in last summer, seen by most people in and around government as best thing that RTE had going for it. Again, any of the events that led to the crisis last year took place before his arrival, and he was very much seen as the guy who's going to kind of clean up RTE and put it on a stable footing for the future. But as Harry points out, he signed off those confidentiality clauses in the packages last summer. That was his mistake. And so he's kind of tainted, and the confidence of a lot of people in government in him has been a bit rocked by that, by the lack of political foresight to know that there was going to be political pressure for transparency about redundancy packages. And
there wasn't any awareness, real public awareness of those payments. Now, he tried to say in an interview earlier this week that he'd said it in a doorstep outside the, but when you actually parsed what he said,
it was pretty vague.
It was very vague. And that's been very, very generous to him. And that was a mistake as well, because there's a whole secret, there's this culture of secrecy kind of narrative which had accompanied RTE, you know, continued.
Well, doesn't it come back to this point where again and again we hear this thing about culture, discussed it in this podcast previously, what is the culture of RTE? And it isn't just located in one or two individuals who happen to be in charge of it two or three years ago. It obviously runs a bit deeper, and also maybe more broadly Irish corporate culture. You know, we're not too unfamiliar with the subject of senior media executives getting substantial lumps of money as they go out the door past, you know, a few feet from here. Similar things have been known to happen.
History of it in the Irish Times.
Indeed there is, and it caused some unhappiness, it should be said, when it has happened from time to time. So presumably Kevin Backhurst just felt he was doing what was par for the course in Irish corporate circles.
But it is still an extraordinary lack of foresight not to know that there was going to be a demand for these packages to be, the details of them to be published. And, I think that was a significant mistake by Backhurst. However you turn it around, whatever context you put on it, he must have known that when he was agreeing these things, he was going to be before a Dáil committee at some stage saying, I can't tell you that there's a confidentiality package. If he didn't know that, then...
But he is, in the words of your article earlier this week, the indispensable man.
I think he remains the indispensable man, even more so now, in the wake of Shunley Rathleague's departure. Though, as somebody else once said, the cemeteries are full of indispensable men.
Yeah. Just, I mean, one last thought on this. There was a sense that there was a process in place, Harry, that RTE was going to get its Grant Thornton report and the other report out the door. They'd have to go back before our Oireachtas committee or two, which happened last week, which really set off this act of this long-running play. And then there were a couple of reports to go to Catherine Martin's department, and then it would be time for the government finally perhaps to consider some new relationship and funding structure with RTE. Has that all been thrown up in the air, I wonder?
It has. You know, there was a sense that the theatre that began last summer had departed from the West End and was kind of moving down towards the end of the pier now in terms of human entertainment. Even though there was a kind of a sting in the tail over the past couple of weeks, the story about two Oireachtas committee having a turf war, you know, over who should have control of the RTE. The RTE narrative has been very good for politicians because it has had a kind of a diverting effect in terms of some of the other issues and crises.
Which are of a far greater scale in many cases.
Of course they are, yeah. And the Oireachtas dealt with some of them this week, which put, I mean, the RTE scandal, bad and all as it is. And it is important because, you know, we need to have public confidence in our national broadcaster, and public service broadcasting is very, really important. And we need to have an independent broadcaster that is fit for purpose. And all of that is very important. But there are other things that were discussed in the Oireachtas this week that really put it in the halfpenny place. The final thing is, I mean, there is a difficulty for Kevin Backhurst and for RTE in publishing even aggregate figures. Cantillon did a very good column this week saying that even if they do that, by a process of elimination, you can very easily discern what each of the individuals has got, because only two individuals benefited from the package in 2023, Rory Coveney and Richard Collins. And we kind of have a fair idea of what Rory Coveney got. So
he got a year's salary.
That, of course, is Backhurst's fault, though. I mean, all the talk about Richard Collins's confidentiality clause, presumably Rory Coveney had one as well, but his figure is being widely reported, and it's been widely reported because Kevin Backhurst said that, you know, that the position hadn't been replaced and RTE would recoup the cost of it by this summer, which is another way of saying we gave him a year's salary.
Salary, yes.
Does any of this matter at all in the broader political scheme of things, apart from for people who have a specific interest in the question of public service broadcasting, which is not insignificant, but...
Yeah, I mean, I would have said not massively, but I think things have escalated quite a bit now. So if the board walks, then I think there's huge pressure on Catherine Martin, and then it becomes a much bigger problem for the government. My sense is that Catherine Martin would dig in, and that is likely then to just prolong the crisis.
And but could also that cause prolong inter-party tensions within the coalition?
Yeah, I mean, I can't see Taoiseach and Taoiseach going to Eamon Ryan and saying she has to go. But it would certainly cause tensions because you'll have no end of backbenchers and maybe even ministers off the record lining up to tell us, you know, that she could, that she should go. And it prolongs the crisis, and it prolongs this phase of the crisis, which has, as I said earlier, its lens focused on government and not just on RTE. So I think it is today becoming a more serious political problem than it has been before now.
Right. We will move on to a subject, Harry. You mentioned there were other important subjects before the Oireachtas this week, and I think this is a very serious one. The Irish Health Service is a large, ungainly beast, and there are some bits of it that actually work perfectly fine and work quite well, and some health outcomes are quite good, and in some areas where it really clearly doesn't. And then among those areas, there is some where the pain and suffering that arises as a result of that are just so glaringly, horrifyingly obvious that, you know, every time it comes to public attention, you go, how can this happen? And there was one of those this week.
Yeah, absolutely, Hugh. Scoliosis and spina bifida. So Sinn Féin brought a private member's motion this week in relation to paediatric orthopaedics, but mainly spina bifida and scoliosis. Now, there's a higher incidence of spina bifida in Ireland because of population genetics than in other comparable countries, and scoliosis, which is such a debilitating condition, but one that can be corrected if one gets an early intervention. Now, the first thing that must be said, that any intervention in terms of any of those spinal issues, they're very complicated. You're talking about very serious surgery.
Multiple surgeries.
Many, many months of recuperation. And also, you need to have highly specialist surgeons, you know, using very innovative techniques to correct the difficulties with posture and with curved spines and with incomplete spines, etc. So it is difficult. So you do need to have very specialist people. But, you know, other jurisdictions have been able to deal with this issue adequately. In Ireland, it has been just disgraceful. So it was quite timely for Sinn Féin to bring forward this motion this year. And it did it in a non-declamatory way. And I you have to give Sinn Féin kudos for the way it approached this issue this week. But the difficulty is that despite all the promises by government over the past decade, very little progress has been made. Simon Harris, when he was Minister for Health in 2017, promised that all waiting lists for scoliosis procedures would be reduced down to zero. Not only has that not happened, but the waiting lists that were there in 2017 are longer now than they were.
And this is for children whose condition deteriorates further and further and further the longer they're waiting.
The earlier the intervention, the better the outcome. So if you have a child who's left for 2 or 3 years, the condition will have progressed to such an extent that the corrective surgery will be far more complicated, that many procedures might need to take, and then the outcomes will be suboptimal. So earliest intervention is best. And everybody is aware of that, and the government is aware of that, and obviously parents are aware of that. One of the children outside the Oireachtas this week was a 10-year-old child from Donegal who's been waiting for a procedure since she was 5. So, I mean, you're talking about critical periods during the formation of human beings when this corrective surgery needs to take place. So the government really essentially put its hands up, both Stephen Donnelly, the Minister for Health, and the Taoiseach, Leo Varadkar, during the course of the debate and during leaders' questions on Wednesday. And the Taoiseach admitted that he didn't have an adequate explanation as to why this problem has not been solved. And Stephen Donnelly also referred to the fact that €19 million in additional funding had been given to CHI, the Children's Health Service in Ireland, in 2019 to bring the time down, to invest in more specialist staff, to ensure that the turnover of operations was higher.
And Sinn Féin zeroed in on that €19 million and asked questions about, well, where is it?
Well, and he wasn't able to explain that. He said he has asked the HSE for explanations and he hasn't been given adequate explanations. And he's asked the internal auditors within the HSE to examine this to see if the money that was allotted was actually used for that particular purpose. So there is
would it not be an absolute scandal if it had not been?
Absolutely. So once the report or whatever outcome to that process is available, people will know as to whether that money was allotted to its proper use or not. If it hasn't been, it's a complete and utter scandal. And I mean, the there were lots of adjectives and lots of, you know, disgraces, appalling adjectives thrown around this week. And for once, they weren't hyperbole. You're talking about conditions that people can visibly see, you know, deteriorate unless there is intervention, and it's not happening. And it's absolutely a black mark for the HSE and for our health services in general, and for the government, which has overall and overarching responsibility for it.
I'm going to ask the cynical question we always ask on this podcast, Pat. Does this have any effect on the politics, the political prospects of the party?
Well, it doesn't help them, does it? But I think that, you know, Harry's description of it there, it zeroes in on one important kind of, or one characteristic way in which this government gets itself in trouble. And it's that it mistakes the spending of money for the achievement of results. It thinks that once it has allocated money, it has done its job, but it actually hasn't. And very often you find that that money doesn't achieve the results that it is intended to. And this is a classic example of that. And that's why you find ministers on the radio saying, you know, is there anything weaker that a minister can say that money isn't the problem here? You know, because the obvious corollary of that is that, of course, it's management and effective grip, which is a sort of, sounds like an intangible quality of a government, but I think people recognise a government that has grip and doesn't have grip. And in this instance, it's very clear that the government doesn't have grip.
All right. We'll take a break here. We'll be right back after this.
At AJ Products, we're dedicated to delivering intelligent solutions tailored exclusively for your business needs, spanning offices, warehouses, industries, workshops, schools, and public spaces. Specializing in warehouse and project planning, we bring efficiency and sustainability to the forefront. Our offerings include versatile storage solutions and comprehensive office project design and implementation. With over 45 years of experience, we stand as your trusted partner in smart B2B solutions. To explore all we have to offer, visit ajproducts.ie and elevate your business with AJ Products.
And you're welcome back, Pat and Harry, you're still here. Now, Michael O'Regan was for many years the parliamentary correspondent of this newspaper. You've probably seen many of the tributes paid to him since the announcement last Saturday of his sudden, sad and unexpected death. You might have got a sense of the warm regard and the affection in which he was clearly held across the worlds of both politics and media, including a minute's silence in Dáil Éireann and including tributes from many politicians, including the president. For myself, I'd just say that he was always a pleasure to meet in the newsroom. He was a big, gregarious, funny Kerry man who wasn't afraid to share his opinions, but he always did it in this particular affable, humorous kind of a way. And that came across, I think, on this podcast, where he was a regular guest up until his retirement in 2019. Here's Michael talking to Pat back in September 2016 about Enda Kenny's leadership of Fine Gael.
And the great horror of Fine Gael is to be pitched into the next election with Mr. Kenny as leader. So that begins, I think, at that stage to have implications for Mr. Kenny.
Yeah, that's why this is the difficulty for Mr. Kenny. If he plans to go on until 2008, which I think he does, but I mean, I don't know that, but I think he does. That's the difficulty for him, because the worst nightmare for a Fine Gael TD is the government collapses and Mr. Kenny is still leader. But what happens in the meantime, Pat? You see, how do you if you want to take him out, who moves first? Mm-hmm.
None of the contenders.
None of the contenders. A lot of people in Fine Gael have jobs. You know, the ministers, junior ministers.
More than half the parliamentary party are ministers.
Yes, exactly. Do they want to jeopardise it? And I think he's calculating how are they going to take me out if I do stay on? And by the way, he's also living in the same house as one of the most skillful press officers that Fianna Fáil ever had, Fionnuala Kelly, who was press officer. Married to Enda Kenny, who was press officer during the Haughey Heaves in Fianna Fáil, and who saw how Haughey survived against the odds. So from that point of view, he's getting some very, very good advice. I think he plans to stay on. My own thinking is that he plans to stay on until the summer of 2018.
Harry, that was Michael getting his predictions wrong, actually. You know, it's a hazard of the profession, isn't it? Enda Kenny was gone within the year.
Yeah, that happens quite a lot, especially in this quarter. It was very Michael. Michael was really fantastic at the personal side of politics, the personal connections. He knew everybody. And he, as you said, Hugh, he had outspoken views. But he always played, unlike Kerry footballers, he always played the ball rather than the man. I'm allowed to take a dig at him because he was always taking a dig at Galway.
A Galway dig,
football.
If ever I heard one. Yeah.
So his main loyalty, of course, was to Kerry. And then after that, he gave everybody their due regard according to their own lives. But there in that clip, you could see his reference to Enda Kenny and that wonderful reference to Enda Kenny's other half, Fionnuala O'Kelly, who we remembered was a press officer for Fianna Fáil and a very good one back in the the 90s.
And also from Kerry, of course.
And also, absolutely. And so that was very much Michael. Michael would make those connections. And if somebody was analysing Enda Kenny, I would have analysed him in a completely different way. So Michael was able to bring his own kind of huge repertoire of words and this lovely Kerry brogue, this mellifluous Kerry brogue, also that huge local knowledge and also this huge network of people he knew. Michael knew everybody. And during around election time, he was always really fantastic in knowing who the candidates were, who their helpers were, and knowing about the details of very small parcels of lands, roods of lands in Roscommon or Kerry or West Cork that could make a difference in terms of politics. And he was just a wonderful person who was upbeat most of the time, who had a very good take on politics and really enriched the fabric of the coverage that we had in the Irish Times and in the Irish media
and
general.
And in some ways, Pat, he bridged, you know, at least two generations of journalism. He was an old school print journalist. I noticed from his obituary, I wasn't aware of this, he was the first graduating class from the first journalism school in Ireland, Rathmines. It graduated in 1971, covered a lot of the big stories in the 70s and the 80s, particularly the Kerry Babies was a big story for him. But he was a really good broadcaster. He had a fantastic voice, and you know, he ended up on this as a regular on this podcast. You know, a long career that in a way reflects the changes in journalism.
And he used to be on Vincent Brown's nightly program quite a lot on radio, and then when that transferred to television, he was on that a lot.
And he was mad for Twitter.
He was mad. was on. I mean, only two weeks ago or so, I saw him on Virgin.
He was a legend on Radio Kerry as well.
Yeah, in a weekly column.
I mean, Kerry County Council spent most of its meeting last week paying tribute to Michael. I mean, that's how much esteem he was held in his native county.
Really, I was actually on Radio Kerry talking to them about him on Monday morning, and you know, everybody was, you know, people were sending in messages, people were phoning in, and of course the Healy Rays gave a moving tribute to him in the Dáil, the highlight of which is they recalled that at their own father's funeral, Michael had come to the funeral and stayed for all 3 days and three nights in Kilgarvan. But he was all over the Twitter, as you say, Hugh. He had a nice persona on it, refused to be bogged down by the nastiness of it. And one of the things I'll always remember about Michael is just that he was, how much he loved journalism. He loved political journalism. He loved being in the Dáil. He liked politicians. He got a great kick out of the whole pantomime of politics that revolves around Leinster House. And I think that was one of the reasons why he was good at it. Because, of course, you know, you're more likely to be good at something that you really enjoy. And he spanned a couple of generations as journalists, as you say, Hugh. And he was also much beloved of a younger generation of journalists, even younger than myself and Harry, who
even younger,
if you can believe that, in Leinster House, who all looked up to him and who he was very good to, in terms of, you know, just sitting in the refectory in Leinster House, having cups of tea, cups of coffee with people, giving them advice, giving them the benefit of his enormous knowledge. There was hardly anybody in Leinster House had a bad word to say about Michael.
Exactly. He was. I mean, politicians are generally people. They like people. They're kind of extrovert. They like the company of people. And Michael was made. Michael's constitution was as the same. He was a person who was an extrovert. He loved people. He loved chatting. He loved gossip. And he got on very, very well with politicians. And he was quite outspoken, for example, in his views on Sinn Féin. He wouldn't have been the greatest fan of Sinn Féin, especially in his retirement. But quite a number of Sinn Féin TDs and senators came up to me during the course of the week to say how much they had liked Michael on a personal level.
That really sums him up, doesn't it?
Yeah, Michael had contacted them, you know, if he'd seen them on television or heard them on radio or making some contribution. He'd sometimes contact them by text or by Twitter to say, I thought that was very good, or I thought you could have made this point or that point. So there was something about Michael that was innately suited to the world of politics. And I think his composition, or the way that he was constructed as a human being, was similar to that of many of the politicians we know. And I think they appreciated that and they got on so well with him, as did all of us. Mm. You know, he was an eminently likeable man, and we'll miss him terribly. We really will.
Gone too soon. He will be greatly missed. This time every week, we have a look at articles that took our fancy on irishtimes.com. And Pat, you've been looking at what young people are drinking.
So this is a piece by Finn McMurredmond, columnist based in London, in yesterday's paper. And she's referring to various surveys that show that younger people, Gen Z and millennials combined, don't ask me to tell you what they are, but
millennials are quite younger, old these days, aren't they?
Well, younger than some of the people out here, and they're drinking less apparently, but they're drinking better quality wine. She says all of a sudden it seems the children are drinking like adults, and the adults are drinking like teenagers. And
is this true in your experience?
Well, in my experience, you just because you drink better quality wine doesn't necessarily mean
you drink less.
You drink less of it. But actually, I think
that's that's a very honest expression of your experience.
I thought you were going to tell a porky there, Pat.
I have an idea for a podcast actually that we might come back to, and we should probably bring producer Declan into this conversation. That
I think he'll have to bring the budget to it.
I think I can describe the landscape of Irish politics in terms of wine. So, Fine Gaelers are like Bordeaux, you know, they're slightly old-fashioned, stolid, reliable, not that exciting. Fianna Fáilers are like wines from the Southern Rhone, and on.
Is it all only French wines?
It goes. No.
Would some party be Buckfast?
Sinn Féin are... hold on, let me consult my notes.
Chardonnay, no.
Sinn Féin are like an Italian Super Tuscan, you know. So I've put quite a bit of thought into this. Now, clearly, there will have to be, as it was at Christmas, more... drinking on air. So,
well, obviously, if Declan's prepared to provide the wines, I'm prepared to put up with it. I'm not sure our listeners will.
What you should do is you should get Declan to maybe buy 30 bottles of wine, going from really good quality to really low quality, then bring in a lot of people, both young and old, and then get somebody to test out the theory.
Okay.
If they're still standing.
Right.
You
better tell security about that one. Okay.
Declan looks quite enthusiastic.
He does look more enthusiastic than usual. Harry, you were looking at a piece by Miriam Lord. It was a terrific piece about spats between South County Dublin TDs.
Oh, that was hilarious. Now, she wrote a beautiful tribute to Michael Regan, by the way.
She
said, the tribute to Michael, the lovely line, she said, if Michael had heard them, he would have died and gone to heaven. I thought that was really nice. Mm. But this was so funny. So there was a row between two Dunleary TDs, Richard Boyd Barrett and Jennifer Carl O'Neill, kind of refereed by Leo Varadkar. So it was a very posh row. I was saying in the Digest on Thursday morning that it read a little bit like a Roddy Doyle play, except that it was set in Dunleary rather than Barrytown. But it was hilarious. So it was a non-row. Taoiseach took umbrage on Jennifer's behalf when she started heckling Richard Boyd Barrett when he was just kind of coming up.
I think it's telling the two key protagonists both have double-barreled names, isn't
it? Yes, to boiling point. And he told her essentially to butt out of the conversation. And then the Taoiseach took great umbrage on her behalf. And it just descended into an awful row. And most of the column is dialogue. But the dialogue itself is just priceless. Mm. Just the interchange between them. It was just priceless. And it was Miriam really at her best. And I really loved it. And I enjoyed it so much when I read it.
Right. My piece is, this is a first, I think, for me, or perhaps in this section. It is it's a letter. And it is from an academic in Queen's University, so it's a very erudite letter. He's the emeritus professor in Queen's University. His name is Ian Montgomery, and he was responding to another letter, because this is the way things go on the letters page, when in discussions about the metro link to the airport, somebody had written in one of those short, pithy letters, you'll be aware of those, asking whether a snail would have made it from Dublin Airport in the time it has taken to plan the metro link. And this professor from Belfast, fortunately, is a professor of natural science.
And he's a specialist in snails.
He answers the question. He says, if a snail had started crawling from the airport into the city centre 20 years ago when Metrolink was first proposed, would it have reached it by now? He says it's a tricky question, difficult to answer with any degree of authority. And then he goes on to answer it. He estimates a garden snail speed can vary, but the fastest can do about 8 metres an hour. But he's estimating at about 3 metres an hour. However, and I quote here, it depends on certain factors, you know, the height of the terrain, low and high temperatures, whether they are following another snail or whether they stop to have frequent rest or indeed sex. So having taken all those factors into account...
And is he taking account of the traffic?
Having taken all those factors into account, he also says that on the basis of the distance between Dublin Airport and the Natural History Museum in Dublin 2, which is obviously where he's going from Dublin Airport, being 13.4 kilometres, it would take 4 to 5 years. Potentially, the humble garden snail could make that round trip at least twice in about 20 years. Unfortunately, then, he does point out that their lifespan is quite limited, so any snail attempting the airport route is likely to end up either lost or dead. And on that note, we shall leave it. Thank you very much.
The caliber of readers that we have in the Irish Times.
I tell you. Yeah, this is why people should subscribe. I always keep forgetting to tell people to do that. Don't forget to subscribe to irishtimes.com for more quality,
won't buy it,
more quality letters.
If you've heard the first cuckoo of the year, please let us know.
Thank you. I've seen no sign of it yet on the letters page. Okay. Which are Fine Gael wine? We'll leave it there. Thanks very much to Pat Adari, to Declan, our producer, and JJ, our engineer. We'll be back very soon indeed. Have a great weekend.